I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And
Patricia T. O'Connor is here. She visits us once a month to talk about the language, and we take your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And when Pat is not here, you can always read one of her books, Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, Origin of the Specious. Also, if you have a kid who wants to know something about the language, Woe Is I, Junior. And you can also email her at mailbox@gramophobia.com. She has a blog there where you can also see a selection of the language questions from WNYC listeners. Have I covered the full thing?
That's about it. Okay. That's about all I'd want revealed, I think.
And her home number is... So when you come by, we usually talk about something that's in the news. I suspect, should I guess, this is St. Patrick's Day?
Yes, but I'm not so predictable as to do a St. Patrick's Day
I had all my Oren Bogora questions.
But I notice I have a green clown nose on my microphone. I just happen to be sitting at the green one, but that was an accident. But no, I wanted to talk about, there is something in the news, but first I want to talk about something that a listener emailed me about. I thought this was interesting. He said he's always had a theory that words that start with WR have something to do with twisting because of the wrist, and that words starting with KN have something to do with the fingers because of knuckles. And actually, there's something to that. English isn't so wacky as you might think. There is an ancient Indo-European root that has given us all of our English words that, well, a lot of them that start with WR and that have to do with twisting. The root meant to twist or bend or turn. And it has given us wrist, wreath, writhe, ring, wrangle, wrench, wrinkle, rest, wrestle, wrap, and others. It may have. And another Indo-European root, meaning to compress into a ball, is the ancestor of many Germanic words that start with KN or an N sound.
Knackwurst?
Yes, actually, knackwurst is in there. Knuckle, knob, knock, knot, which K-N-O-T, which means comes from to tie into a knot. Knoll, knife, knead. And even food names like knackwurst and gnocchi.
Gnocchi, wow.
Yes. So I thought that was very interesting. You'd think that knee and kneel would be in there because the knee is bumpy. But actually, that comes from another root meaning angle, I guess because of the bend. And knack, which a lot of people wonder about sometimes. He has the knack for something. It may come from a German word, knacken, meaning to solve a puzzle.
Of course, knisch doesn't fit into any of these things.
No.
Well, that is really interesting.
Right.
I guess what we forget is that all of these languages, every so often we see these connections, one language with another, they all come out of this Indo-European basic language, which I guess is also kind of Sanskrit?
It's pre-Sanskrit. Sanskrit is one of the Indo-European languages. But these are all prehistoric. And actually, Indo-European is only one prehistoric language family. There are others.
That have fed our languages, the European
that have fed,
base languages?
Well, that have fed other languages, say Arabic, Hebrew, for instance, not an Indo-European language, Chinese, of course, the Asian languages.
And I would assume that some of that filtered into Europe, at least through the Mediterranean countries.
Probably. But
Greece, for example.
Right. And this is a field that has just opened up a lot recently, where linguists are almost being able to trace the DNA of languages. It's quite fascinating.
Wow.
But I wanted to mention one other thing that was in the news. You probably heard about the Drew University freshman who was charged with stealing valuable documents from the university archives, including one letter from Abraham Lincoln. Allison Cowan at the Times did a story about this, and she emailed me because she was interested in this Lincoln letter, and it had apparently a grammatical error in it, although, of course, it was beautifully written, being Lincoln-esque. He used the possessive its, spelled I-T apostrophe S, and she was a little surprised about that, and
he could have interned for me on the show. Pretty much every one of my interns says that and also writes the word lose, L-O-O-S-E, for some
really?
Reason.
Really? Huh. Well, I did some checking, actually, and Lincoln was not a man to make mistakes in his writing. And it turns out that the possessive form of it was originally I-T apostrophe S.
Really?
Yes. This was in the 1600s. And throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, that was the predominant form in print, was I-T apostrophe S. Only later were people bothered by this because of the confusion with the contraction.
Mm-hmm.
And so the non-apostrophized version fought it out with the apostrophe, and it wasn't until really well along in the 19th century that it became standard to not use the apostrophe for the possessive its. So Lincoln didn't necessarily make a mistake. He may not have been on the cutting edge, but we can't say that he goofed there.
Should we take some calls?
Yeah, let's do.
Okay. Our number again, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And Chuck from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hello. Speaking of punctuation, I've been trying to learn some characters in the Chinese language, and I'm wondering how their calligraphy and their language will affect English in the near or past or future. You know, I know I said that all mixed up, but I hope you understand.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we'll try to translate it.
Yeah, I can't answer that. It may be too early to say. Leonard knows more about Chinese than I do, having studied Mandarin, right?
Well, I just lived in Chinatown, so I picked up a bit of Cantonese, I was fascinated by the fact that the same characters are pronounced so differently, so that
mm-hmm.
Thank you is xie in Mandarin and doce in Cantonese, but you write it the same.
Uh-huh.
Or you say ni hao for how are you, and le ho ma in Cantonese. But you, Chuck, you were pointing out that the word wo means I in
correct.
Mandarin. So
yeah.
Pat, is when she says
wo
is I, she's
well,
actually just telling us something about Mandarin that she didn't even know she was telling us.
That's correct.
Gosh.
Thank you so much for calling us.
That is an interesting question, though. I don't know how the Asian languages, especially Chinese, are going to affect English. We'll find out.
Now, the next caller is asking a question that has been asked in the past, but people keep on calling about it. So rather than ignore it, let's address it one more time and then put it to rest, okay?
Okay.
Laura from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Yes. I guess I'd missed the shows when you talked about it before.
Well, you must have gone missing at the time.
I must have. Anyway, I grew up saying so-and-so's child disappeared from the yard, and lo and behold, in the last couple of years, I'm hearing that the child has gone missing, which sounds grammatically wrong in my head, and it's like nails scratching against the board because it doesn't make sense grammatically to me, gone missing.
Actually, it's an idiomatic expression, and like a lot of idiomatic expressions, it doesn't always make sense when you parse it out exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more common idiom in Britain than it is here. At least it has been in the past. I first noticed it in the late 90s when JFK Jr.'s plane disappeared momentarily over the Atlantic before it was learned that he had crashed. And all the bulletins said that his plane had gone missing. That's the first time I remember hearing it widely in this country. And after that, it's everywhere. But it's a a British borrowing that's an idiomatic expression, and it seems to be very useful here because we're seeing it everywhere. It's entered the American vocabulary.
Now, Laura, when you hear someone saying he went on holiday, you know that that means went on vacation because that's the British way of saying it, don't you?
Well, yes, but also because I lived in France for a while, and they go on holidays in France.
But it doesn't bother you.
And that doesn't bother me.
But that's just as don't you think that's just as unreasonable to say go on holiday? A holiday is a holy day, and you're really just taking a trip to some other location.
What about go on vacation? When you think about it, why don't we use the article there? Why don't we say
why don't we take a vacation?
Well, or go on.
Let's take a trip to Bermuda this time.
Let's get away from it all.
Thank you for calling us.
Let's take a kayak to Nassau or Nyack.
I think that so many of the calls that we get are about changes, and although that enriches the language, there is this natural inclination to resist those changes. They sound odd to us at first.
People ask even about common idioms. I answered an email a couple of days ago from someone who was very bothered by the expression to clean house. She thought we should say to clean the house or to clean my house.
I wouldn't say that. To clean the house would mean to me to clean every corner, every inch.
Right.
To clean house means...
Right,
just
to tidy up.
Yeah.
It could just mean clean house in your office. And we say cook dinner. We don't say cook the dinner or cook your dinner. We say cook dinner. We don't always use articles with things and because we don't always need them.
Well, in some languages, you have to use the article every time. And often, foreign speakers use articles which sound odd to us.
True, and often foreign speakers who don't use articles in their own language are baffled by the way we use them. So I think articles are very idiomatic, like prepositions.
A listener, Kate in Queens, has a St. Patrick's Day question. She says, I'm curious to know how Irish speakers have most influenced the English language, if at all. I would think they've had a major impact.
You do think they have?
Yeah, sure.
I'm not so
maybe
sure.
Maybe on American English.
I'm not so sure about vocabulary, but maybe about accent in some places and sentence structure. But there's not a lot of Irish vocabulary, I don't think. There are not a lot of Gaelic loanwords in English, not as many as you would expect.
Considering the impact of India, for example, on the English language or some of the other former areas that the British controlled.
Right.
Okay. Ray from Cold Spring, New York, you're on the air.
Hello. I have three Dutch questions. A Dutch treat, a Dutch uncle, and I'm in Dutch with my boss.
We did a show once. It was something like the founding of New Amsterdam, the anniversary of it, and we talked about Dutch words. And the English and the Dutch had an animosity that went way, way back to the earliest days of exploration, till before New Amsterdam was founded. And the British colonials in the United States had a lot of negative expressions that involved the word Dutch, and they involved cheapness. The Dutch were supposedly cheap. Falseness. A Dutch uncle was not really an uncle, and those sorts of things. It all has to do with the fact that we developed a lot of pejorative expressions with the word Dutch in them, because of the British animosity with the Dutch.
I've heard Dutch uncle used as a silent business partner.
You have?
Yeah, I've how'd you get the money to open that restaurant? Oh, I have a Dutch uncle.
I've never heard that.
I haven't either. I used to think it was a fake uncle or someone posing.
But, you know, throughout Europe, you have these things where people often use the enemy country. There are certain things that that are called French by people who want to put it
down.
English, if you want to put it down.
Venereal diseases. Mm-hmm. Were that way. The Germans called them the British disease, I think, and the British called it the French disease. And we managed to work these jabs into our slang language, and a lot of them stayed.
Although there is a Dutch oven, and I think that's rather nice.
Yeah,
there's
I don't
know. Double Dutch.
Pardon me?
There's double Dutch.
Yeah, what is double Dutch? I can't remember.
It's a rope skipping game.
That's right, but doesn't it mean something in slang etymology?
We're going to have to go look that one up.
Maybe you're in double trouble. If you're in Dutch, you're in trouble.
Tom from Massapequa, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'd like to introduce a word that I saw evolve when I grew up in Brooklyn in the 1950s and 60s, and it's the word club sandwich. And I used to go to the Jewish delis and watch how the European or Polish Jews would order turkey or some other meat, and they said, put it on the chleb. And the American guy behind the counter would say, what? And the Polish guy would say, I want some turkey mit chleb. And so the guy said, so you want a club? You want it on club? And I believe that's a derivation of the club sandwich. And that came to my attention only because...
But that's not what the dictionary says. The dictionary says that it probably comes from the fact that club sandwiches, which are not on that kind of bread, usually, were popular in hotels and clubs.
Could be. But
yeah, there's no...
There's a New York club sandwich, which is different. A turkey on club, you got it in a New York deli, is not the same thing as a club sandwich that you're going to get at a restaurant in most parts of the world.
The club That's sandwiches I always got in restaurants were on white toast.
Yes.
Not that I asked for that.
But that's what a club sandwich is.
What I'm pointing out is the word club comes from the word chleb, which means bread in Polish.
I got it. But I'm saying that I think that that's not the derivation of club sandwich. That's the derivation of the New York club sandwich in a Jewish style deli, which is a whole other world.
I thought I discovered something. I married a Polish woman, and I thought I discovered something in the root of the word. And I thought it happened, and
happen.
You know, there are coincidences everywhere. But I never thought of that before. In fact, it's been a
club.
The club that we're talking about is like a hero sandwich. In a Jewish deli Eastern European style deli.
The people think that because it's in the bread is in the shape of a club, and then it seems to have escaped Brooklyn and gotten out into the rest of the world and diners and everything.
Or vice versa. Maybe it invaded
Brooklyn. Well, I think we've cleared this one up, and we've got to take a little break. Our number here, by the way, is 212-433-9692. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, author of many books on the English language, and we will continue our conversation. By the way, you can also drop us a little comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll continue all of this after we take a little break. Stay with us.
Give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase.
And of course, Mel Tremé was referring to Patricia T. O'Connor, those three little words, or maybe to the titles of any number of her books. Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me. And then she went and messed the whole thing up by doing Origin of the Species, four little words, and Woe Is I, Junior, another four little word, Pat. I guess consistency is the hobgoblin.
Yeah, well.
A listener, Mike in Brooklyn, says that words like cool, phony, gimmick, dude, to call, you know, to say uncle when you're when you're giving up, that they all have Irish origins.
Really?
I have no idea whether
that's
true, but
that's new to me. If so,
And another listener, one in Bushwick, wants to know the origin of rinky-dink. Do you know rinky-dink?
I don't.
And I don't think anybody does. It's one of those things
that... It might be
that,
just one of those rhyming rhyming slang phrases.
From what I understand, all we know is that it originated in the United States around the turn of the century, 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But I think rinky-dink, it probably is that. But it's interesting that when you hear rinky-dink, the first time, you know right away that it means...
Yeah, piddling.
Yeah. Something small
yeah.
and not
someone
all that
also,
serious.
Didn't someone ask about nook and cranny?
Yes. Well, no, let's speak to the person who wants to know about nook and cranny. What line is that? Okay, it's Edward. Hi. Oops, I'm having trouble.
Favorite breakfast treats.
Hi, Edward.
Hello. One of my favorite breakfast treats is a Thomas's English muffin, and they advertise with all those wonderful nooks and crannies.
Mm.
But how does one distinguish between what is a nook and what is a cranny?
Nooks and crannies, or nook and cranny, is one of those redundant phrases that's it's like a humorous redundancy. A nook is described as a small corner or alcove, a little out-of-the-way, hidey-hole sort of place. And a cranny is a crevice, or it can actually have an opening. So these are really quite similar words. It's much more effective than if you said, with all those nooks, or with all those crannies.
Uh-huh.
To say all those nooks and crannies,
mm-hmm.
you see. So a lot of phrases are deliberately redundant like that. And they're intended to be that way.
Oh, okay.
And it's more fun, don't you think?
Yeah, it is more fun. Gives the language a little zing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sort of like rinky-dink.
And, there are other brands now of English muffins that I think are better than Thomas's. What do you think?
I like crumpets. Have you ever tried crumpets?
Yes.
They're kind of in the family of English muffins, but they don't have as many crumbs on top.
Neil from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm very excited. I've been meaning to ask this for a little while. So I'm a Shakespeare educator in various schools in the New York area, and it was my observation that the students would constantly, when going into Shakespeare, would default to a modern British dialect. And so I wanted to nip that in the bud and did a lot of research into early modern English or Elizabethan pronunciation. And one of the things I came across is that the V sound in the middle of the word would typically be dropped, and you see that expressed like, what error, E apostrophe ER, or devil would be pronounced dill, which led me to the word evil, which would then be pronounced ill, which we sort of know as ILL, and which we kind of use interchangeably with evil, like I mean you no ill, or I don't want to do you no ill. I've been shamelessly pandering that in classrooms, saying this is an example of why you don't need to be precious or pronounce this language like a modern Brit, because it sounds differently anyway. But I was wondering if you had heard anything about that, or if you knew of any other examples of dialects that over the years have come to found a word that has a different meaning from its initial intent,
mm-hmm.
but it sounded differently because of a dialect from an earlier form of English.
Well,
in some cases, like ne'er-do-well, we don't even ever say the V.
No, we don't say never-do-well. Right. But I've read that or, spelled O apostrophe E-R,
mm-hmm.
and air, spelled E apostrophe E-R-E, were actually poetic devices, and people didn't necessarily speak that way in the ordinary language, that this might have been used by dramatists or poets, but it wasn't necessarily the way the man on the street spoke.
That the V-dropping was an affectation of sorts by stage actors?
Well, or that they may have done this for purposes of meter, or in the case of ne'er-do-well, it just sounds better. I'm sure that even the man on the street said ne'er-do-well.
No.
But
you wouldn't want to say he's a never-do-well. That's boring.
This issue of Elizabethan pronunciation, my husband and I, in our most recent book, Origins of the Specious, did a chapter on British English and how it's changed over the centuries and how it relates to American English. And you know that the modern British accent really is a production of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Do you know that? The R dropping?
The Hanover pronunciation is what influences the contemporary British dialect, like dropping R's, which wasn't the case for Elizabethan.
Right, they didn't drop R's at the end. They didn't use the broad A's like poth instead of path, or father instead of father. So their pronunciation really was more similar to ours than to a contemporary British speakers.
And the way we know this is because of British poetry, right? Because
right.
Rhymes, mm-hmm. Many of the rhymes make more sense if you speak with an American accent.
True. And we know, for example, that poets late 18th century rhymed vase with face. They rhymed ant with can't. There were a lot more short A's in British pronunciation back in those days. And we know this not only from the poetry, but we know it because people wrote about it at the time in pronouncing dictionaries and whatnot.
Making a conscious attempt to distinguish their accents from American accents, or just
No, it was probably a conscious attempt on the part of Londoners to distinguish their speech from that of provincials and Cockneys.
It's also been pointed out that some of those words like Chumley, which are not spelt like that at all, mm-hmm. Were a way of distinguishing the upper classes from the lower classes.
Huh. I didn't know
because
about
they were
that.
The only ones who who would know that this very complicated spelling wound up being something rather simple
uh-huh.
in pronunciation.
Uh-huh.
By the way, a listener points out that Dutch oven is a pejorative, that it's not really an oven, so it's another one of those put-downs.
Yeah, it's a dish, a pan with a tight-fitting lid. Ah.
I love my Dutch oven, so...
Yeah, I do, too.
I thought it was nice.
I make bread in mine.
Yeah, me too. Judith from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
We're well.
I'm glad to get the chance to ask this question. And speaking of pejoratives, I've always been annoyed by the phrase the likes of, and I'm always correcting people in writing. I'm an editor. I'll always quickly change it to such as.
What's wrong with the likes of?
I'm sorry.
No, I was wondering, what bothers you
about?
Yeah, I consider that just another idiom of the sort that... allows us to not always say like.
Well, I guess when I was coming up, the likes of was a mild pejorative, like, you know, I'd never be seen with the likes of you. Mm. You know, and then you're going to have a sentence like, this person can be compared to iconic artists, the likes of Van Gogh and Jacob Lawrence. To me, that's just a little odd. I'd rather say such as. I wondered if that's legitimate or if I'm just being...
You're just being you know.
Okay.
one meaning of the noun like, and this is the noun mm-hmm. rather than the preposition, or it means one that's similar to or like another. So
right.
He has an expensive car and the like, meaning and similar things. And when you say the likes of, it doesn't have to be pejorative. It's often used that way. But you could use it to mean the likes of Nobel Prize winners. Mm-hmm. He's up there with the likes of Einstein and Paul
okay.
Krugman. So it doesn't have to necessarily be pejorative. Now, one thing that often is used as a pejorative is the word ilk. When you say so-and-so and his ilk, that often,
right.
again, that doesn't have to be pejorative, but it mostly is used in a pejorative way. But that doesn't mean it's ungrammatical.
I say thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We thank you. And we have Michael now from Maplewood. You want to clear up the whole Irish influence thing?
I certainly would like to.
I certainly do. Okay, let's hear it.
Actually, a guy named Daniel Cassidy, there's other scholars that have sort of debunked what your guest said about there being no real derivatives from Gaelic and the Irish language into English. He has a book called How the Irish Invented Slang, The Secret Language of the Crossroads. His name's Daniel Cassidy, and she should check it out. And I can't go over them, but there's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of words. Like
do you mean,
shack.
Oh, and these
crony,
are... Were these introduced by Irish Americans into English?
They were introduced by Gaelic-speaking Irish into this country. you know, quite a bit before the famine, and you know, in the 1700s and 1800s and on, and he gives the Gaelic derivatives and meanings, which, and the pronunciations, which are almost as close as you can get, and gives instances in some cases. Oh,
that's interesting. I'll check that out. Thank you.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah,
of course, there's
on a day like today, you know, you don't.
Yeah.
There's another reason to believe that the Irish have had a major influence, and that is the great Irish writers. Jonathan Swift, James Joyce, Oscar Wilde.
Right.
I don't know whether they actually introduced words, but...
Oh, Joyce did.
I mean, words that we still use?
Words.
I thought Finnegan's Wake was just gobbledygook.
He did introduce two or three that we still use. I can't remember what they are. I think I did talk about them on the show once. But as far as I know, they aren't Gaelic or Gaelic-influenced. I was thinking of direct Gaelic borrowings.
Let's take another call. This one is from Mark from Paris. Are we talking Paris, France, Mark?
We are. Hello, Patricia.
Is this Mark Neymark?
I've often written to Patricia. I've never actually spoken to her.
Yes.
So hello.
Hi.
Mark, I was hoping you were calling from Paris, Texas, but Paris, France, well, that's okay.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. So I'm calling. I have another question that might take some research, so I think I'll write to you about it. But the thing that I wanted to ask you about today was what I think is a misuse of a term. People say early adapter when I think they should be saying early adopter. And so I'd like a ruling from you and you know, appropriate punishment for people who say early adapter.
Well, I'd have to know the context, I think.
Well, the context is for technology, you know, people who are keen to be the first to use the you know, the latest iPhone, and so they adopt it early.
Yeah, I would think that would be adopter. An early adapter would be somebody who changes something early.
But that could they could be connected. For example, somebody who was one of the early users of the internet would have been an adapter along with being an adopter.
Yeah, if he adapted it to his own uses. Mm-hmm. He may have adopted it early and then adapted it to his own uses.
But I think that the point is well taken. They are early adopters.
I would think so, too.
And I just about the Gaelic thing, if I can follow up, I think that I remember on Language Log, I think it was, something about the fact that the work that the caller referenced was not actually...
Well, we can't go any further because we've run out of time, but thank you so much for calling, Pat. We'll see you on
Mark.
April 20th.
Yes, I'll see you then.
On tomorrow's show, we'll discuss the impact each of us can have on the health of the planet by doing small positive things, and then learn about the life of Henrietta Lacks. She died of cancer in 1951, but her cells were kept alive and have changed the course of medicine. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lorraine Adams on her novel, The Room and the Chair. Plus, our latest underreported segment looks at a secret campaign of ethnic cleansing in Burma. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Todd McGovern. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.